Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. There's a heated debate over controlling student numbers again. We'll get across that. We've got new research on cost of living and belonging. We'll review activity on campus in the wake of the situation in the Middle East and which universities are best for social mobility. It's all coming up.
I mean, the whole tenor of the correspondence with universities is enormously finger-waggy. So, I mean, I think the tone is absolutely reprehensible.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here to help us get acquainted with this week's developments, as usual, three fabulous guests. In the Shard today in London, Rachel Sandby-Thomas is Registrar at the University of Warwick. Rachel, your highlight of the week, please.
Highlight, low light. All I would say is a lot of time has been taken up with the current Israeli Gaza development. So I couldn't call it a highlight, but it has been occupying a lot of my space.
There we go. And in Wool's End today, Gary Hughes is Chief Exec at Durham Students Union. Gary, your highlight of the week, please.
Selfishly, because I'm a homosexual of a certain age, I'm going to go and see S Club 7 tonight, or S Club, however many we have remaining. So I'm just mostly focused on that.
Excellent stuff. And in Tamworth this week, Sunday Blake is Associate Editor at Wonky. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is actually today, because I'm going to see the whole Wonky team in person at Senate House Library. And then
if you can get the train from Tamworth, that is.
Exactly that. And then I'm going to the Evasys Student Engagement Conference, which is in the same building. So that's very exciting.
Busy day on the trains for Sunday. So yes, we start this week with student number controls. On Monday, Policy Exchange published proposals for King's Speech content, and there was higher education material in there, Gary.
Yeah, it's that time of year, isn't it? It's various think tanks and policy people are producing what we want the government to do in the King's Speech. The Policy Exchange report itself has got quite a lot of proposals in there, considering there's one author, he's got a lot on his mind. But particularly, there's something which always surfaces whenever governments or policy people are thinking about money and education, which is student number controls. Now, the Policy Exchange report ostensibly is talking about the need to fund skills development. And he's talking about a tax credit for organisations to spend on non-statutory or functional training. That's a very old idea, isn't it? There's the apprenticeship levy and all sorts of ways of address that. And maybe that's a good policy intention. But not everything needs to be funded by taking things away from higher education. And I think that is the flaw in it, isn't it? That the author, Ian Mansfield, wants to talk about the fact that higher education is costing the state far too much money because too many people are engaging in it. He speaks about the fact that there are any institution that offers a place to somebody, that person gets funding, and it's just unsustainable. I think my major issue with it, of course, is that HE and FE and skills development in adults are all important areas of policy. It's not the case that you have to rob from one to fund the other. But I do think we're going to see over the next year, certainly as we ramp up towards an election, a discussion about the massive priority of education. You know, it's one of Keir's missions. It's something that, Julian Keegan is getting a lot of airtime comparatively. But it will be a really sad, lonely debate for those of us who care about education policy if everything is in the context of HE's got a lot of money, other bits of area need money, so let's just rob universities. It's not like the sector isn't doing incredibly important work in developing responses to challenges today, and I think we need better suggestions than are coming out from Policy Exchange.
Yes, interesting. Now, Rachel, obviously, on the one hand, this is, as Gary says, a sort of too many people are going to university, and it feels like Ian Mansfield here is having a different run at trying to reduce the number of people going to university, having done lots of the stuff around, minimum entry criteria and so on. But the other argument I think that Ian would make if he was on the podcast this week would be the Treasury has to control its spend somehow. and this is a way to control it.
I know. Well, I must say, I find this completely, mad and muddle-headed, this whole debate. So if we go back to why we had student numbers, it was exactly what you're saying Ian would say, that, you know, it was government funding. They were doling out so much money, they had to control it just the same way that they do because they fund doctors. So, you know, doctoral training. So they have to keep a cap on it. And that's fine. But why was it taken off? It was taken off because they stopped paying for fees and they made them into loans. So just because it swishes past the corners of the student loans company, they are treating it as if it was their money. But actually, the students are treating it as it's their money because they have to repay it back. So it makes absolutely no sense to me. So either you go back, you get rid of loans, and the state actually properly funds higher education once again, and therefore you have the rationale for introducing student numbers, caps on it, or you stop pretending that they are directly funding universities via loans when those loans sit with the students, and you just let universities get on with it. So it seems to me that what he is trying to do is the worst of all possible worlds.
But Rachel, to be fair, there's a balance, isn't there? Because it's not you know, loans versus full funding. There's for, you know, for a couple of decades now been a sort of hybrid where the state does put some money in and graduates put some money in. Now, albeit that over the past few years, the calculations and the changes to the system mean that graduates will be putting far more in than they used to, the state still is putting a subsidy in there, and the state ought to determine how much that subsidy is and where it goes, hadn't it?
Well, I would be very interested to see the breakdown, because it doesn't feel at all as if the state is subsidising anything, quite frankly. It feels as if it's universities, or actually it's the universities and the students who are paying for most of it. But if we go back to why the student number controls cap was taken off, it was taken off because loans were introduced. And if anything, if there is so much direct government subsidy, that was part of that debate. And the rationale behind it was loans were not direct finance, therefore student number controls weren't appropriate anymore. And I don't think anything has changed since that decision. Now, if the rationale for this is, which is somewhat different, is that too many people, it's considered too many people are going to university, then they just kind of need to say that and they need to remove the aspiration, but just be upfront about it. But you also, I mean, it's very difficult to stop people without doing the number controlled. So actually what they should be doing is trying to make other routes more attractive. And you don't necessarily do that by saying university bad, evil, look at these ghastly universities, when in fact we are actually part of the jewel in the national crown. You make other things more attractive, like apprenticeships and like FE funding, our FE courses. But then, of course, you're going to have to increase the amount that's been put into FE, because FE has been absolutely robbed by Treasury over the years.
Yes, there's obviously a strong argument that says that what this proposal is literally level down rather than level up, level down HE rather than level up FE, which is, of course, the opening paragraphs of AUGUR. Sunday, obviously one of the allegations whenever there are kind of number controls floated of any sort is that the first people that will suffer will be students from disadvantaged backgrounds.
Mm. Okay, right. I'm so glad that you've asked me this, because I would just like to set the record straight here, because I've been watching this debate for a few days now, and it really annoys me when people say that student number caps is a wonky editorial line, because I have a lot of opinions on different issues, but this one I don't have opinion on, because I haven't thought about it enough to formulate an opinion, and I don't want one attributed to me. So I'm setting that straight. Now, I do have concern that, and this is why I stay quiet on this issue, by the way, because these are my concerns. So I have some brain vomit around this and why I'm anxious around it, and I don't want to have a set opinion. So, like, you've got, obviously, as you say, like, student number caps, the first concern is, like, if we're capping numbers, who is it that doesn't go? And, like, on one side of the spectrum, you've got your sort of mummies and daddies who read the Times, and they're already concerned that, you know, Alfie and Amelia aren't going to end up going to university. So good luck selling that to voters at election time, right? But then on the other side of the spectrum, you've got people in favour of, like, social progress, mobility, widening access, And they get very concerned that it's marginalized students who end up not going, which is actually quite a reasonable position to take. So unless we're sort of implementing better access measures alongside student number controls, the policy could be quite regressive. But then there's this kind of like student experience line as well that sort of goes round and round in my head, because you've got these horror stories that are coming out of the student housing sector this year, right? So low stock, overcrowding, and like something does need to be done about not just bums on seats, but also like bodies in beds, if that makes sense. And that's not even taken into account like staff capacity and learning space. And people who argue against student number caps have not addressed the housing issue like in a satisfactory way for me, because they seem to think that like housing will just magically spring up, and unless universities are actually doing something about like rent controls on the other side of this, the access argument is out the window. In terms of finance, we can't have maintenance increases unless we're doing rent controls, because landlords just raise rents in line with maintenance grants. And, you know, we may as well like take the student out the middle and get Student Finance England to just directly pay their mortgages off. And then the other argument from the no cap crew is that if students can't afford to go to university, then they just won't go. And it's like a magic hand of the market. Numbers will magically be controlled. But like cost of living data from the Belonging research that we've launched this week, it shows that students aren't dropping out. They can't afford to go, but they're not dropping out. They're just having a really bad time and they're not engaging it meaningfully. Now, last point on this, I promise, it's about three lines. Turn it on its head, right? Okay, fine. We bring in number caps for home domicile students to ensure availability in the rental market. But when institutions ramp up their recruitment of international students to compensate, we then wave goodbye to those extra beds. And not only that, these students are more vulnerable to rogue landlords and rogue letting agencies, because they'll be signing contracts while overseas or in a rush while they've landed. And I'm lying in bed at night, not knowing what to do about this, not knowing what to think about this. And in the wise words of Marcus Aurelius, I'm just going to choose not to have an opinion yet.
No. Well, I mean, for someone with no opinion, someday that was a roller coaster ride. Rachel, look. One of the things that you know is clearly true about this debate, and to be fair to Ian Mansfield, he has put some stuff in that not just talks about accommodation, but responds to the idea that universities shouldn't grow too fast. And there's something about geography here, isn't there? About where we might want public subsidy to go. And where we might not want it to go because of the impacts on places.
Yes, that is true. So can I just add to the thoughts of Eddie Going Round in Sunday's head? Because, of course, regulation and policy is a very, very blunt tool. So, you know, at Warwick, we actually have a surplus of accommodation, a surplus of it. So I don't see why our student number cap, we should have been subject to that, because we could take more students and accommodate them with a kind of ladder of rents. So there's lots of affordable accommodation as well. So I just wanted to say that. Yes, it's very true. I mean, in many ways, you know, this whole move to regional power and devolution of power out of London should be giving rise to those kinds of debates. And certainly what I see, a lot of the kind of the big, quite powerful regional devolved authorities and things work very, very seriously with their universities and regard their universities absolutely as kind of anchor institutions and partners. But of course, you know, the way that the government is doing this local devolution, strength begets strength and weakness just gets weaker. So in many ways, it is probably... I mean, I haven't done a survey of this, but my working assumption is that the poorer and less powerful local authorities and areas probably don't benefit from having universities who are strong partners for them and could do with that in order to kind of kickstart their economic growth and help them with it. So, yes, I agree. I kind of think there is an argument for kind of somebody from going out and talking and at least putting those ideas and helping them put together a sufficiently powerful business plan to make it happen.
Gary, if I was talking to your student officers at Durham Students Union, I would certainly over the past few years have heard versions of, well, the university's expanding too quick.
I do think there's something to be said. I mean, let's be charitable to Ian and Policy Exchange. There's something about a need for planning, which is being understood as a need for national control. So national control, I think the point Rachel made in terms of a blunt tool of regulation, and Ian's proposing it, no institution shrinks by more than 5%, but that is still quite a lot of people and money. So I think a national approach to this is going nowhere. But planning, I think, locally is a really interesting debate. You're absolutely right that universities incentivized or pressured to grow at certain paces in certain areas have done so. And that's been a policy imperative that's really hard to avoid, so they've done it. I do think there's something to be said about, in the Policy Exchange report, about the criteria upon which Ian proposes that institutions would be allowed to grow or be controlled. And it includes, as Sundar and Rachel said, beds. It also touches on things like the national skills analysis and advice from the Migration Council on skill shortages. But were that locally, were an institution able to grow locally and plan itself in terms of its skill profile, its housing? That's so complex, but maybe that's got some legs. Because you're right, Durham had to is the contentious issue, grew by choice in certain areas because certain things were incentivised. If other things were incentivised, perhaps we wouldn't have problems with housing and we'd have more part-time or distance education. Maybe we'd have less need to grow business as a thing that brings in a lot of subsidy across the institution, and we would have had more incentive to grow languages or other things which are particularly important.
But better, I think, carrots, fewer sticks.
Absolutely. Always the mantra.
Interesting stuff. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Sian Waring, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about leadership and the attributes that differentiate the best leaders. Lots of people at all career stages have the attributes for leadership, and I know because I meet them every day. I hope you can spot some of your own attributes in my blog. I want to encourage conversations about leadership and leadership literacy. Fostering the right attributes in leaders from early in people's careers will lead, I hope, to a more diverse and therefore better leadership in the higher education sector. And better leadership will lead to better higher education. Even if your job title doesn't say head of or dean or director today, I hope you'll be thinking about whether one day you'll be just the right person to lead a university.
Now, on Monday, we published some new stuff that we've been working on at Wonky with Pearson on cost of living and belonging, Rachel.
So, probably unsurprisingly, they find a link. Maybe more surprising was that out of the number of students they spoke to, about 60% felt that they were managing okay, which I thought was quite high. I was quite surprised by that, but 35% were struggling, and it seems to me perfectly natural that when students were struggling to meet their kind of cost of living costs, they were, they are not feeling as if they can join in and make the best experience of their university life, which of course then affects their sense of belonging, and that to me wasn't a surprise. I mean, obviously it's a disappointment, but not a surprise. One of the things that I thought was very interesting coming out of this, though, was that, and this felt very counterintuitive, that of the ones, of those students, the ones who were struggling were much less likely to ask the university for help. So those that were kind of feeling as if they were managing okay would ask the university for help, but not the ones who were struggling. And I thought that felt very counterintuitive, and I think really deserves a kind of a further dig through conversations with those students.
Now, Sundar, you've been across this, close to this, and will almost certainly have theories on that.
Yeah, I do. First of all, as one of the authors of the report, I think the large percentage of students managing okay is a reflection of the amount of students who have time in between paid work and study to sit down and do a survey on the cost of living. So do bear that in mind. I think, like you said, those who can't meet costs are less likely to ask for help. And this does fascinate me, because at the moment, we see cost of living as like a sort of across the board tangible issue, generically affecting everyone, needing tangible, generic across the board solutions. And we have to understand that there are intangible concepts of entitlement, stigma, comfort, individuals living normality, rationality, the ability to identify an awareness of your own needs and a sense of belonging. And you can get the exact same initiative and the exact same comms reaching some students and not others. And there is this, like, because I did the qualitative work on this, which is going to be coming out at a later date. There is a deep psychological process and impact around being poor. And if we fail to understand it, we are failing to understand the students' experience in it. What we're not going to do as a sector of professional classes go, oh, those working class, they're such a proud people. Like, we're not going to do that. But what we are going to do is understand the psychological and the practical. So the psychological, right, Jim, let me ask you this. If you allow me to speculate from my lived experience of growing up in abject financial and emotional poverty, which student is going to be the one more comfortable and more entitled to ask for help? The one who is given a generous pocket money allowance simply for gracing their parents' lives with their presence, or the one who dragged themselves up through childhood and had to earn from the age of 13 or 14 every penny they ever spent? And remember that the latter of these two, okay, the latter has learned to live without. They are used to making do. They know what poverty is and they know how to get through it. Now, on a practical level, poor people are used to hedging our bets. So you've got a cost of living bursary fund, and I say, all right, okay, do you know what? I could sit down all evening, spend several hours laying bare my soul, my bank statements, my inside ledger management, whatever it is, and I could possibly get 50 quid. Or I could spend the evening working in a bar and definitely get 50 quid. What am I going to do? Because you know what? No, it doesn't surprise me at all, this outcome. It does not surprise me at all that the ones struggling to make ends meet are the ones taking up help, and the ones who can't make ends meet are going and bearing it on their own. Doesn't surprise me.
Interesting stuff. Now, Gary, you in recent years have worked at both the University of Sunderland Students' Union and the University of Durham Students' Union. And I guess, you know, in terms of your lived experience of kind of, you know, serving those different sets of students, one of the things, you know, certainly the HEPI Student Academic Experience Survey pointed out earlier in the year is that this is really a tale of multiple sets of students. And you must reflect on that quite often.
Yeah, it's the first thing I should say is that both institutions are full of brilliant, lovely people who care intensely about the issue. The difference, I suppose, is the realisation about what that means in reality, as Sunday said, from the perspective of somebody who isn't involved in the deep committees, who doesn't influence policy in the same way, and is just the victim of policy decisions. But that's not to say that both institutions aren't full of people who care a lot. The thing that really stood out for me in the research was about the proportion of people who feel their university is trying to support students with the cost of living. And it really surprised me that more people who are generally able to cover costs think their university is supporting them, whereas people who are struggling to cover basic costs, there's a smaller proportion of those students who think that their university is trying to support them. Now, I do absolutely agree with Sunday that is, there's a lot of psychology in that, and I'm looking forward to the qualitative response. I was also really interested in some work Wonky did, which showed that work at Durham is one of the few places that has actually shifted its student support thresholds over the past couple of years in terms of the Durham grant. And that is because of Durham officers lobbying really hard for that. But the key difference, again, riffing off Sunday, is that when you're struggling to survive, your ability to engage in policy decisions about support thresholds is minimal. Like, you're living your life. Actually, the experience that you have means that you need to work, you need to make short-term decisions and short-term survival decisions. Whereas we have been really lucky at Durham in that we have had a degree of social capital and a degree of comfort where we've been able to negotiate at policy levels for everybody else. I think institutions can do a lot more in terms of incentivizing or making accessible access to those policy decisions, because otherwise it will increasingly become informed by well-intentioned people, but who will get it just not quite right. And that is just such a shame when there is such a lot of need and such a lot of opportunity.
Rachel, I guess as well as that sort of, understanding both the psychology and the practicalities of this stuff in terms of different types of student, there is something else going on here, isn't there? Which is the richer institutions tend to have the richer students and have got more money to spend on this type of support. And the poorer institutions have got more poor students and they've got less money to spend on this type of support.
Yes, that is probably true. Albeit I would say that, I mean, I can't speak for other institutions, but I know, you know, increasingly, I mean, Warwick is a relatively rich because it's a successful institution, but, you know, we are putting more and more money into those schemes. But as you say, you know, it's because we have the luxury that we can afford it. I mean, I thought Sunday's response was really interesting. And what I would say is, and, you know, and also what Gary was saying about reducing the threshold and publishing more widely the policies are really good suggestions. But any more suggestions that comes out of that research to help universities reach those poorer students and provide support for them without, as she said, patronising them or shaming them or anything like that, I think universities would really, really embrace that.
Yes, interesting. Now, before we move on, Sunday, just give us a quick sense of where this all goes next.
So we have got we've got another report coming out, which is basically looking at the qualitative elements around this, and the findings of which should be being launched at our Festival of Higher Education next month. However, we still have got some focus groups to run, which I am looking forward to, and they're going to be great. But it means that I'm going to be sat cross-legged on my study floor with surrounded by post-it notes once again, which is actually me and my element. So I don't know what I'm saying, but yeah, it's going to be great. Keep tuned. Keep tuned in to Wonky for that.
Now, the Israel-Hamas war has intensified this week, and so has conflict on campus, Gary.
Yes, I think the thing to say, you know, it's important we talk about this because it is happening on campus, but the degree of harm, fear, anxiety that people who are affected because of their location, you know, our students and staff who are in the region, our students and staff who have friends and family in the region, is so urgent and visceral. I think it would be really callous and unwise not to acknowledge that at the start. Rachel, I know, and I have been in so many meetings at our own institutions trying to find a way to think through this at the moment. And there's a lot of guidance coming from national government, from DfE, from the Home Office, from FCDO, from loads of places about trying to help universities understand how to navigate this. Now, Rob Simcox, who is the new government anti-extremism and anti-terrorism head, counter-extremism czar, that is his title, is speaking today about what, in his view, may be a permissive environment for anti-Semitism. I think it's important to acknowledge that that is not untrue, like that there are anti-Semitism is tolerated in ways that other forms of racism are not. It is made into a debate about is it real, is it experienced, and that is a harm that our Jewish staff and students have experienced for years and the sector has struggled with. I do think, though, that Rob's analysis of how that has come to be in terms of a failure of cultural and multicultural policy is just as unhelpful a blunt tool. I think it's, if anything, I've learned over the years of being part of student unions and part of leading responses like this locally, is that sensitivity and sophistication is really hard, but so important. And I think I would have hoped that a first intervention into this space in such a complex time recognised that. He hasn't made the speech yet at time of recording, let's be fair, but I do think this is something where care is just so important.
Now, Rachel, you will have been handling and dealing with all sorts of bits and bobs on campus this week, presumably in conjunction with the Students' Union. Give us a sense of some of the kind of tensions that have come up.
There are obviously the kind of the political tensions, which are felt very strongly on both sides, just as they are in the actual region themselves. And, you know, obviously emotions are running very, very high, which is what you'd expect. And, you know, and people are very, very traumatized by what's happening, as well as fearful. And again, that's on both sides. So, you know, I must say, I am kind of with Gary that anything which is potentially inflaming the situation seems to me to be deeply harmful and ill-judged. So our kind of, you know, high-level concern at the moment is to try and reduce any kind of inflammatory actions where we can to try and provide whatever support and concern that are felt by, you know, all sides of our campus community, and to try and, as best we can, to kind of foster that sense of we are all in it as a community, and we need to be kind and supportive to each other, and we won't tolerate kind of anything that, you know, is lacking kindness. Having said that, of course, you know, there is another tension, which is kind of at the more kind of legal policy end, which is the tension with free speech, which, as we all know, with the legislation, you know, there is kind of enhanced scrutiny and emphasis on free speech at the moment. And that tension is quite a difficult one to manage. So, you know, the legal position is relatively clear in the fact that, you know, obviously the Terrorism Act kind of trumps free speech. But the Terrorism Act itself, I don't know if any others have kind of read it, but, you know, it was passed in 2000, very much in the wake of 9/11, and there is very, very little case law on it. And what case law there has, it would be really, really easy for student societies who feel very, very passionate to fall the wrong side of the line with potentially, you know, really dreadful consequences. So we have been trying to, while not stifling any kind of freedom of expression, just trying to send warnings that actually this is really, really tricky territory. So it's a really difficult position on every single...
Sunday, obviously on both Wonky Live this week for those that saw it, and on the site this week, certainly I've been discussing the problem of kind of context, right? So you can evaluate whether something is anti-Semitic or glorifies terrorism from a content point of view. But then when you place a set of behaviours in context, there might be an additional kind of evaluation to do. You know, the waving of a flag or the using of a phrase might not fall, you know, might not be bannable in one context, but would be bannable in another. Now you will be familiar with those debates in the early part of the last decade around lad culture and the argument that said, whilst types of lad culture weren't in and of themselves counting as harassment, allowing lad culture to flourish was leading to actual harassment later. And it seems to me that on the one hand, there are people in this debate of the sort, you know, as Gary said, Robin Simcox, arguing that allowing lots of pro-Palestinian activism and demos and rallies and so on is, you know, the kind of, you know, the environment in which extremism can flourish. There are other people that would say, well, hold on, it's really important that we kind of hold on to free speech, and that, you know, students have got a perfect right to protest and celebrate and, you know, back the Palestinian cause, albeit that they obviously haven't, you know, that should steer clear of promoting or glorifying terrorism. So that context question is almost impossible, isn't it, for, you know, a student's union or a university or even a student society?
No, I understand what you're asking. I think for me, this comes back to, and my heart goes out to student unions who are trying to deal with this at the moment, by the way, because I can remember being a student union officer and you do end up sort of helicoptered or parachuted into these, you know, deep political issues that you might not have much knowledge of. And I think with lad culture and with especially things like anti-Semitism, I don't want to use the term microaggression, but like these are issues where unless you know what to look out for, so things like rape myths with lad culture, things like anti-Semitic dog whistles, right? These are things that an events coordinator in a student union on 27 grand is not necessarily going to have had the training and sort of background to really like thoroughly understand. And it was something that we really struggled with when I was a student union president, when the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill started coming in. And we would have, we didn't have a big block grant to go by. We didn't have legal people to consult, but we did have the university sort of breathing down our neck saying, why has your event coordinator on 27 grand just given the green light for this known fascist to come? Well, you know what I mean? It was sort of issues like that. And I think this is an area where universities are really going to have to like understand that they're going to have to elevate their student unions to a sort of board level and really ratify their ability to, you know, regulate, coordinate, understand the issues that their students are facing, understand the political issues that the students want to talk about on campus, that want to sort of exercise their free speech, and all the while understanding, you know, the tangible fear and harm that other students may be experiencing from that. I do see some student unions that are doing it really well, but yeah, I would say that it's about capacity, it's about resources, and it's about getting to the heart of the issue as well.
Gary, one of the things, obviously some of this is about, you know, there being people who can make the case that even if something isn't unlawful or illegal, it may well upset other students. And we ought to want students to at least think about the impact they're having on other students. But the other thing that strikes me is there are other actors around, aren't there? So, you know, a student union was talking to me the other day about a demo, you know, pro-Palestinian demo that they'd risk assessed and so on. But then when it actually happened, there was concern that various other kind of community groups and community actors had sort of turned up, almost hijacked it. Some were offensively wearing paraglider stickers. Do you know what I mean? I mean, the permeability of higher education and its student body is even more significant than it perhaps was in the early part of the last decade. And the permeability question was big then too.
One thing I would say, just following Sunday and Rachel, is that I think it's important not to frame the uncertainty or questioning decisions just around students. I think the number of staff in institutions who are making decisions or are the first point of contact with things who are also unsure what to do and might make the wrong decision and need to support it to make good decisions is really important. And that, I think, is how I understand your point, Jim, which is that so institutions are just so big with so many connections to so many people, that actually the way in which the permeability point comes up is just everywhere. I think about, for example, the you know, I'm aware of one university as well as its student union who have had a lot of press contacts where people have been going through student Instagram accounts going, this person is a student at your place and has said this thing. This staff member at your institution has said this thing. Mm. And the institution, the student union, having any form of responsibility for that statement is clearly not, they don't. But there is a sense of responsibility and sense of, but what are you going to do about it? And that's the point at which I think campuses and communities have to be really good at talking to each other about what do we do about this? Because the sense that there is a single answer, which is always university applied, is just going to be far too blunt. The unfortunate side that I think we find from our experience thinking about Ukraine, thinking about some of the conflicts in Hong Kong, thinking about some of the things all across the world, is this isn't going to be a... this is going to go on for a while. And actually, we're going to have to make a number of decisions and convene a number of conversations about what we do. And as people, external actors, complicate that, we need to get much better at recognizing them, you know, having contacts with local organizations. There is obviously a complication in taking advice from that from only the police, from only the Home Office. I think it's really important that institutions and student unions are really part of civil society. So engaging with community religious groups, talking directly to UJS, to CST, to other organizations who can actually offer expertise, because you're absolutely right. We are just so complex, permeable institutions these days that there is a real risk.
Rachel, I've read a couple of letters this week, one obviously from Gillian Keegan to universities, and one actually that's come out this morning from Gillian Keegan to schools. And one of the things that's really noticeable is the difference in tone. So, you know, the one to schools is actually quite supportive in terms of, you know, trying to dial down conflict on campus, whereas I did think that the government's letter to universities was quite finger-waggy.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, it's just quite... I mean, the whole tenor of the correspondence with universities is enormously finger-waggy. It just depends on quite how quickly the finger is wagging. This wasn't wagging quite as quickly as some of the other letters we've had. But even so, I mean, I think the tone is absolutely reprehensible. And the thing that really, really irks me is as if we need to be told. I mean, as if. You know, universities are already doing this. You know, the letters always come too late by the time they've all been kind of wordsmithed. She's never actually run a university. She has absolutely no idea what is actually involved on the ground. And that is pretty much the same of DfE and OFS. And they always come, we're already doing everything that, you know, she is telling us to do. And the implication that we wouldn't be doing any of this unless she told us to do it, you know, quite frankly, is insulting. At the best. So I hadn't seen the one to the schools. All I can say is I'm very glad that she writes to them in a nicer tone than she writes to us.
Now, finally this week, London South Bank University's English Social Mobility Index is out, published by HEPI. Sunday, who's adding value?
Right. So, yes, as you said, London South Bank University's English Social Mobility Index has been released, and it ranks universities in England based on the social distance. Does it feel really weird to say social distance after COVID? But anyway, social distance travelled by their... Based on the social distance travelled by their graduates, as in social mobility, not as in COVID. In previous years, we've had a top 20, but this year, all of the Office of Students Registered providers, excluding specialist institutions, are included. And this is using a data set from 2021 to 22. The University of Bradford, Ashton University and City University of London take the top three places, and they are followed by three Rust Group universities, which are King's College London, LSE and Queen Mary's, and then three post-1992 universities, Birmingham City, Wolverhampton and Huddersfield. And the index is calculated by using measures of access. So the proportion of entrants from indexes of multiple deprivation, quintiles one and two, but quintile one is double weighted, and combining these with continuation measures and graduate outcomes. All graduate modes of study do feature, but this year apprentices have had to be excluded due to a shortage of comparable data.
Now, Rachel, down six places to number 26 for Warwick.
I know. So we need to look at it really carefully to try and see what is going on. And of course, it may be that actually, even though we are doing very well in ourselves, it's just, you know, others are doing better. And I do think that, you know, many of the universities mentioned, to which I give credit and applause, you know, are very good, especially the ones in London, at being able to connect their graduates with jobs in their local economy, which can be trickier potentially when you don't have so many. I think we've got about 27% of our graduates stay in the region, but they're kind of the rest dispersed. But obviously kind of more to do, but it is something that we take enormously seriously as well.
Gary, one of the things I worry about with this exercise is that a university can be kind of quite good on access for a group of programs and then quite good on, you know, graduate salaries for another group of programs, but they might not be the same students. I find it hard to visit a medical school and think, well, you know, on the one hand, a medical school will be propping up the salary numbers in this index, but, you know, that medical school almost certainly won't be propping up the access numbers in this index. And that's a problem, isn't it, with large universities like of the sort we have these days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I absolutely agree with you, Jim. I went through an access scheme to get into the University of Birmingham about a million years ago and was very aware that when I left university with my colleagues, they went into like the city and were earning mega bucks. And I went to work in a student union. So the access kid actually did not earn a lot of money compared to people who had an awful lot to start with and continued to get quite a lot. But of course, you don't connect the various points. It's like a plunk, like you don't know which end of the straw you're going to pull. I do think, though, charitably, this is a relatively new index and it's talking about the right sort of thing in a way. Could it be improved? Absolutely. Yes, it could. You know, would I love Durham to be better than 74? Yes, I would. But I am interested, I suppose, in that this is an attempt by London South Bank to have a debate about this issue. But I absolutely agree that unless there was some form of longitudinal, long data on people's progress and that sort of stuff, wouldn't that be lovely? I think it's interesting if flawed.
Sunday, over the past year or so, I've been dealing with a family member's death. So I've been, you know, I've been the person in the family that's been, you know, sorting out all the admin. And at various points, someone's had to watch me sign a piece of paper. And you get that list of professions, don't you? The kind of, you know, all the... And each time I've found someone from a profession, I've often thought, I wonder which university they were from and what background they have. And I guess, you know, one of the worries would be that whilst this does surface a debate about about, you know, the relationship between inputs and outputs, the danger is it allows the university to feel comfortable when actually it might not be making that much difference to those really important, you know, professions that end up feeling like they run the country because they have to watch you sign a piece of paper.
Do you know, that's really interesting that you're breaking it down by course and subject and school, because you're absolutely right. There does need to be a more granular approach to this, I think, if I can get my work. Yeah. So what I'm going to say is that it would be interesting to see this breaking down a bit more by course, school, ethnicity, gender, disability, geography, because actually there is, as you say, like we do need a more detailed understanding of how people from different backgrounds going into different professions experience social mobility. And of course, area codes provide some insight. but within this data, demographics like, say, take working class British students, working class British students of Chinese and Indian background who do go more into like medical schools do extremely well on social mobility outcomes compared to their white counterparts. And I think if institutions want to look at their ranking in this table and learn from it and sort of shape policy interventions and initiatives around it, then yeah, we'd need a more thorough breakdown there.
Rachel, obviously lots of people at the moment, in England at least, are thinking about the planning processes to develop their new access and participation plan. And obviously one of the things people are invited to do is look at student characteristics and look at gaps. But actually, interestingly, of course, we don't have a department of Afro-Caribbean students, and universities don't have a department of poorer students. They have academic departments. And, I wonder about the kind of practicalities of being able to influence kind of both access and participation practice at kind of subject, program, faculty level.
Yes, well, I think that is true. I mean, we have a kind of an inclusive education program as we talk, which at the university, and you know, our education executive, you know, are very much kind of owning this, and a lot of the way that they do it is by talking to the departments, you know, at a pretty granular level about what they're doing, what they could be doing more of, and what they and what they need support with. So that's kind of how we do it at Warwick. Can I just say something, though, slightly different, which is a bugbear of mine, and it very much is about how this government views the success of students, where everything is measured by salary. And again, it's such a blunt instrument, and I find it insulting. You know, there are lots of really, really worthy, society cannot function without them types of jobs which don't pay very well, and the students and graduates who go into those jobs should be applauded, not viewed as if they're failures because they're not earning as much as they would be if they went into the city. It's such a crude measure. I mean, all of the kind of, you know, the outcomes data is measured on it. It was supposed to be in as a pro term because they didn't have the department didn't have any other data, but they were supposed to look at it and review it and try and start building up that data. So as well as, you know, Sunday's point about kind of looking at characteristics, especially including intersectionality as well, which I think is really, really interesting too. And it needs to be looked, all the data needs to be analysed from that light. But we need a different way of judging success, not just financial.
Gary, it's a point well made, isn't it? But I guess the danger is that some people hear Rachel's argument and think, well, that's whataboutery and excuses.
I agree with Rachel's point in part, I suppose, but you're right, Jim. I think that salary is important, isn't it? Like, we can't talk about in the other parts of this podcast about the impact of cost of living and affordability and the extent to which salary matters to students and, I suppose, their families, as well as a way in which they have some freedom in the world, because that is what matters to them. That is a measure of how they think they gain their freedom and a chance in life. I reflect that one of the most mortifying and embarrassing things that ever happened to me was when my vice chancellor's PA took me for a dinner so I could learn how to eat properly. Like, I'd never like gone to a 3-course meal before. I didn't know what forks were when I stood up, when I took my jacket off, and I knew how to eat. Like, I wasn't like a savage. But cultural capital, like how would you measure that in an index? But I absolutely agree with Rachel's broader point that social mobility, if it is the ability to talk to people, to know when to say things, where to go to things, what to wear, how to behave. I mean, how do you measure that? But if you don't get that through university, where do you? I mean, Durham is so, it's civilizing, I suppose, that sense of being able to grow in company. But I don't think there's a very easy data collection method for that, is there?
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Rachel, Gary, Sunday, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Until then, stay wonky.